Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. So I'll bet you didn't know there was a warehouse in New Jersey responsible for processing billions of dollars in small bills. But right over the river from Manhattan, there is a branch of the Federal Reserve Bank that ships huge amounts of cash, including much of the money that the United States used to fund the transitional government in Iraq. And a new article in Vanity Fair tracks nearly $12 billion in small bills that were used to prop up the Coalition Provisional Authority. That was that interim phase of the government in Iraq between April 2003, when Saddam fell, and June of 2004, from where they originated in our backyard to where they disappeared, and the word disappeared is apt here for many of them, into the streets of Baghdad. Two of the magazine's contributing editors, Donald Bartlett and James Steele, followed the trail of money from the Federal Reserve Warehouse. And when they talk about following the money trail, it was never more literal than in this story. And they found that of the $12 billion airlifted to Iraq in cash over that 14-month period, of all the things that were airlifted, by the way, I guess cash was not one of the things you had heard about, right? An astonishing $9 billion of that $12 billion is today unaccounted for. So Donald Bartlett and James Steele join us now to talk about their new article, The Corruption They Found in Iraq, and the difficulties in following the trail of unmarked bills that disappeared into that country. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be here, Brian.
Good to be back, Brian.
Who wants to start? I had no idea about $12 billion in cash and, I guess, more, and, you know, truckloads of $100 bills and 20s and 5s and 10s being driven around the greater New York area.
I know. We didn't either, Brian. It's one of the things that intrigued us so much about this story from the very beginning. There had been headlines about all this money that had been airlifted to Iraq, and we simply got curious. And this is the way we often work with any story, like, where did it come from? How did it get there? What was the process? And when we dug into this, we found out, just as you mentioned earlier, that the money actually originated in a warehouse 10 miles west of Manhattan. Everybody knows about the New York Federal Reserve Bank in Lower Manhattan, this august institution. But over in a mile west of Giant Stadium in a town, East Rutherford, that's not exactly on everybody's radar screen, there is this huge facility where money is shipped in and out all the time. And this is where, when this order came in, from the Coalition Provisional Authority and others in Iraq to get this money over there so that they could use it on a short-term basis as a transition into to make sure people had walking around money and other things, supposedly, the money all came out of the Fed. And what was amazing to us, a whole new set of terms here. BRICS are a term for tightly packed bills, whether they're $1 bills or $100 bills. They put brick upon brick, thousands in some cases, in shrink wrap pallets, just like you might be shipping children's toys or something like that. And they put these in, not in a car that said armored car, not in a truck that said anything like that, but in unmarked 18-wheelers that then disappeared onto the New Jersey Turnpike, obviously armored escorts on either side of it. But can you imagine driving down the New Jersey Turnpike, all those trucks, those cars, and looking up at a truck and wondering what's in that truck?
And imagine if there was an accident. You know how once in a while one of those trucks gets in a crash?
Right.
And, you know, 400,000 oranges go rolling down the turnpike, something like that?
We kept asking a lot of people about that question, and the only one, apparently the only accident of that sort that did occur was once one of these arrived. They were shipped from New Jersey down the turnpike to Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington, and apparently they did open the back of one of these trucks one day, and all kinds of money came spilling out because the shrink wrap had broken. But that was as close as they came to a disaster over there.
All right.
The disaster was, as we know later, was elsewhere.
Right. In Iraq, I think we need to set a little bit of the institutional context of what was going on in 2003 and 2004. The government at the time was the Coalition Provisional Authority, so-called, kind of a slapdash government in which the normal rules of government oversight, I guess, didn't really apply.
What's interesting, Brian, about the CPA, and those initials definitely do not mean certified public accountant, is that it was not a legitimate organization of the U.S. government, even though it was run with taxpayer money. It was not created by Congress, not set up by Congress. It was created basically by fiat, by General Franks. And as a result...
General Tommy Franks, who was the lead commander for the whole region
for
the
invasion.
Time. Yes.
Right. And there was no oversight here. There was no responsibility. The CPA could do whatever it wanted. It was not accountable to anyone. And what you saw in the aftermath is incredible fraud, which continues to this day because that first year really set the tone for what would follow.
And there's a paradox here, I guess, about what the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, was and wasn't, because as your article tells it, they made a point at the time in Washington of insisting that this was not an arm of the United States government, because they wanted to convey the impression of multilateralism, that this wasn't a U.S. occupation of Iraq. This was a coalition, the famous coalition of the willing, right? And so,
exactly.
But along with that came a lack of accountability to U.S. standards of oversight.
Exactly.
Exactly. No oversight whatsoever.
What was the method for distribution of this money supposed to be then? Was there a plan that wasn't followed that allowed $9 billion to go missing, or just no plan at all?
The plan, as far as we could tell, and which we pieced together in the story, is that there was essentially no real plan. The money arrived over there. The idea was to get this cash into circulation supposedly as fast as possible. Some of the money went to outlying regions, the north and the south. But the bulk of it stayed in and around Baghdad and various facilities there. One that we tracked a lot of the money to was Saddam Hussein's former palace in the Green Zone, which was the seat of government for Iraq, was also the seat of the Coalition Provisional Authority and this sort of makeshift Iraqi government, such as it was in that 14 months before Paul Bremer turned it over to the Iraqis. That's apparently where a lot of the money went. A lot of it went to Iraqi banks, at the instruction of various Iraqi ministries. But what we sort of realized and found early on in this was that a lot of the mistakes, just as Don was mentioning, that had persisted since and were really created from the very beginning. Not only was there no plan, not only was there no oversight, but the bulk of this money was turned over to Iraqi ministries headed by people who had never headed anything, because all of Saddam Hussein's department heads had been thrown out of office. The new people in these agencies not only had no idea how to run things for the most part, but were looking over their shoulders constantly because of the total political instability in Iraq. They thought they were either going to be thrown out of office or lose their life, or both perhaps. And as one soldier told us, and which was to us really a memorable quote, and he was there at the time, right from the very beginning, and he said, rather than building the nation, every one of these people that he saw was interested in building themselves, taking care of their own retirement. So from day one, you had people, the money disappearing into the hands of these agencies. There was no specific accounting as to once $1 billion went to the Ministry of Finance in Iraq, where it went to. And there's never been an accounting of that to this day.
You do write in the article that, to be fair, the CPA really did need money desperately, and it really did need to start spreading it among the traumatized Iraqi population. It also needed to jumpstart Iraq's basic services.
No, that's absolutely true. But then it just sort of unraveled very quickly. And, you know, it's a little misleading to say there was...
And unraveled in a literal sense here.
Yes.
Because the very next line,
yes,
in your article from what I just read was, as the CPA demanded ever greater amounts of cash, the pallets of $1, $5, and $10 bills were soon replaced by bundles of $100 bills.
And it was with the introduction of the hundreds that the money really began to disappear in earnest. But that's not to say that they didn't, you know, they did put procedures in place in theory to track the money. And one of the first orders issued by Bremer was to create to hire a certified public accounting firm to track the cash expenditures, to track all CPA expenditures. And they did. They hired this company called North Star Consultants.
Tell us about North Star Consultants.
Well, North Star supposedly was a certified public accounting firm, but it had a very mysterious background. It operated out of a house in a suburban home in San Diego, in La Jolla, just outside San Diego. And its postal address was a post office box down in Nassau in the Bahamas. And that same post office box also happened to be the former home of one of the giant Bahamian frauds of the late 1990s, in which $200 million disappeared from investors around the world, including a lot of Americans who wound up losing their pensions and retirement money.
So how did they get this gig?
We talked to the this fellow who got this this remarkable contract, a very mysterious fellow, and he claimed that he saw it advertised on the Internet. I mean, the fact of the matter is, when we also talked to Paul Bremer, he said that basically the Pentagon was the one that executed that contract. The Pentagon, for its part, refuses in every way to discuss this contract, how it was awarded, what the follow-up on was. It's just complete deafening kind of silence, which is typical of the way they're monitoring and overseeing the entire war. But the North Star contract was a fascinating one to us for a couple of reasons, and it sort of shows both the secrecy that's going on over there, but also the incompetence. When we asked for this contract, they blacked out 90% of the pertinent information. But it was through tracing a few things that we were able to find out generally where the company was located. And then through some other business indexes in Southern California and California, we were able to get the name of the company. So then we could find out the name of the person, who he was, and call him. But what they didn't black out, which is astonishing to us, is what Don has just mentioned, this post office box in Nassau. You would think a bell would go off in the whole Pentagon CPA contracting process if the mailing address is an offshore post office box, but apparently it didn't.
And also, this is the kind of company, it was set up as such, an IBC, that are usually formed by people who want to launder money, for example, or conceal assets or avoid income taxes. And you would think that somewhere in the Pentagon another alarm bell might have gone off, but it didn't.
We're talking with the investigative reporting team of Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They followed the money trail literally from the Federal Reserve warehouse in East Rutherford to Baghdad, where $12 billion in cash was airlifted during the first year of the occupation after Saddam Hussein fell, and $9 billion went missing. We can take your phone calls for them at 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. Their article in Vanity Fair is called Billions Over Baghdad. 212-433-9692. And when we continue in a minute with Don Bartlett and James Steele, we will see about the tracking of that $9 billion after it went missing. What do we know today about what actually happened to that money and how much of it was honestly spent? Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Tomorrow morning we will mark the 6th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, looking at what has changed since that day in 2001. We will have a special edition of our program beginning very early tomorrow, 8:40 tomorrow morning, so that we're on in time to commemorate the anniversary of the moment when the first plane hit the first tower. Our guests tomorrow morning will include Clark Kent Irvin, former Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security when it was first created. Also Roger Cohen from the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune, who's written compellingly about some of this recently, especially with respect to what really has changed since 9/11. So join us for our special 9/11 edition of the Brian Lehrer Show tomorrow morning. We will be starting early, 8:40 tomorrow morning on 93.9 FM and AM 820 WNYC. Also tomorrow morning, if you'd rather listen to the ceremony from Ground Zero, we'll have that live online. You can hear it streamed at WNYC.org. We are talking with the investigative reporting team of Donald L. Bartlett and James B. Steele. They followed the money trail from the Federal Reserve warehouse in New Jersey to Iraq during the Coalition Provisional Authority era there from 2003 to 2004. They found the $12 billion in cash. You don't usually think of $12 billion. You say, we're spending $12 billion in Iraq. Well, you don't think of it in ones and fives and tens. But that's how a lot of it got over there. They say $9 billion is now missing in their new article in Vanity Fair, Billions Over Baghdad. And let's take a phone call. Al in Valley Stream. Al, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Great show. Listen, I wanted to ask our intrepid reporters here. This is not an excuse for having the Pentagon waste money, but every year the government can't account for $30, $40 billion. And I wondered why these intrepid reporters don't do a little investigation of where all that money's been going every year.
It's on the list, Al. I'll tell you that. It's on the list.
It's on the list.
The list grows and grows and grows, and you're absolutely correct about that.
Well, go ahead, sorry.
No, you're absolutely right about the disappearing money from the Pentagon, and it's on the list.
I think one of the reasons this particular story attracted us so much is that, unlike so many other aspects of money, which are appropriations and so forth, this was actually cold, hard cash that supposedly was going to be traceable and observed and so forth. And the speed at which it just vaporized once it got over to Iraq just became sort of symbolic about everything else that's happened over there. But your point is well taken.
But Al, also, funny enough, Don, you were just telling me during the break that you wanted to put the $9 billion of missing cash into the larger context of all the contracting fraud that has taken place in Iraq.
No, that's right. The CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, had under its control during that 14 months, roughly $23 billion. That does not include billions of dollars of oil revenue that also has disappeared. And the extent of this fraud and waste and corruption is just incalculable.
Jack in Rye, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jack.
Hi, I've got a great story told to me by a friend of mine who went over as an advisor to the central bank, former employee of the U.S. Treasury, former employee of Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He, from in 03 and 04, was an advisor to the Central Bank of Iraq, and talking about the problems of currency, this is the anecdote. When that currency, at least that part of it allocated to the central bank, arrived, a real question was getting it out for distribution, because the economy was paralyzed and they needed currency in circulation. The problem, once you had the money in Iraq, the currency in Baghdad, was how are you going to get it out to the outlying areas so that the commercial banks could draw down from their accounts at the central bank, get the currency, and people would then have access to money. The story is that it was very hard to get the U.S. Army provide convoy protection for shipping the currency from Baghdad out to the regional offices. But in one instance, they did get the, and this is the anecdote, they did get the coverage from the U.S. Army to ship it down to the Central Bank branch in Basra. What happened was that the currency got safely stowed in the Central Bank branch in Basra. The British Army, hard up for cash, broke into the vault and took the money and used it for its own purposes.
Wow. All right, Jack. Thank you very much. Did you ever hear that one before?
We did not hear exactly that one, but we heard variations of the point we tried to make in the story was that whether the money went to Basra, whether it stayed for a short time in Baghdad, or whether it went north or some other facility, there basically was no oversight. And once it went to these places, it might have disappeared in that fashion. It might have disappeared. It may have gone into the hands of somebody from an Iraqi commercial bank who then did not account for it in some way. Some of the people we talked to were over there amazing. The money was brought around in gunny sacks out of some of these vaults. Another fellow we spoke to delivered the money out of the back of a little pickup truck to Iraqi subcontractors who supposedly were legitimate.
They were being paid in cash.
And he had to get in return for that a receipt for the money. I'm sure all of us would be happy to provide a receipt for any amount of money received under those circumstances.
Right. And this wasn't just a Iraqi contractor.
Usually receipts are for money paid.
Right, exactly.
Right. This was American contractors also being paid in cash. So this isn't just Iraqi.
And there's also the question of whether people cared. I'm going to read from your article. It says, the pervasiveness of this why-should-I-care attitude was driven home in an exchange with retired Admiral David Oliver, the Coalition Provisional Authority's Director of Management and Budget. Oliver was asked by a BBC reporter what had happened to all the cash airlifted to Baghdad. And here's this transcript. Oliver: I have no idea. I can't tell you whether or not the money went to the right things or didn't, nor do I actually think it's important. Interviewer: not important? Oliver: no. The coalition, and I think it was between 300 and 600 people, civilians, and you want to bring in 3,000 auditors to make sure money's being spent? Interviewer: yes, but the fact is that billions of dollars have disappeared without a trace. Oliver: of their money. Billions of dollars of their money. Yeah, I understand. I'm saying, what difference does it make?
Brian, you put your finger on something that's really very important here, because this is a series, an exchange that appeared only basically in the British press and British radio, not in the U.S. And it really, it reflects the tone that ran through Iraq following the invasion. Now, here's a country in which we invade. We get rid of a dictator who has been stealing from the people for years, and we replace that process with a democracy which continues to steal from the same people. That's what's wrong with it.
To what degree was this Iraqi money? I know we're talking about U.S. dollars, but there's a theme that runs through your article that says this was Iraq's money.
This was essentially Iraqi money. I mean, there was some U.S. taxpayer money toward the end there, but it was essentially Iraqi money, both in pounded funds in this country, United Nations oil revenues that were under their control. So this was money that was the Iraqi people were entitled to, which is another part of the story. A substantial amount of this really went to U.S. contractors, not to Iraqi pensioners, folks on Social Security and so forth. I mean, the exact total amount of that nobody knows to this day. The interesting thing about Oliver's comment about could we have 300 auditors running around, well, the whole thing would have been better off if they'd simply had one auditor there from day one, but they didn't even have that.
So you talk about these U.S. contractors. Let me ask you about one, Custer Battles. That's a company with a name that, if it didn't exist, we would have to make it up. Custer Battles, one of the businesses that received a no-bid contract for security in Iraq. Talk to us about Custer Battles.
Well, Custer Battles was one of those American contractors that received the cash up front to start the business, basically, of guarding the Baghdad airport, or the flights into the Baghdad airport at a time in which there were no flights. In a course of a year, Custer Battles, and it was named after the two founders, had $100 million in contracts. Now you're talking not just Iraqi money, but U.S. taxpayer money as well.
Fred and Mineola, you're on WNYC. Hi, Fred.
Hey, how you doing?
All right.
Good. Listen, I just read an article in the National Affairs column in Rolling Stone magazine of a similar $12 billion in $100 bills that got sent over to pay, you know, defense contractors and stuff like that, and $8 billion or so of it was missing. I was wondering, is this the same money, or is this a totally different exchange of missing funds?
This is the same money. Okay. What we did, though, was we looked into the background of why this happened and where a lot of the money went, and the fact that incomprehensibly there was not any kind of an internal real auditing function in place by the Coalition Provisional Authority to make sure this didn't happen. This is the story that Don mentioned earlier, this bizarre company out in California run out of a fellow's house that whose business in part was home remodeling and improvement, gets a contract to track the whole issue of billions of dollars being airlifted to Iraq. Tells you a lot about the management skills of the way we run this war, right?
Drew in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Drew.
Hey, how you doing? I was just, you made the comment that it seemed like you were a little surprised that they were delivering this money in cash to these contractors over here. Now, I know it shows a huge lack of management skills on their part, but there was no banking system in Iraq at the time, was there? I mean, if they wrote a check for $1 million or $50 million to a contractor, could those guys cash that check?
No, and this is a very good point. This is why you absolutely needed controls on the distribution of the cash. And at the very least, you needed a system in place that would track where the cash went, who got it, and what it was used
for. But he's arguing that just the fact of paying them in cash shouldn't come as such a surprise, considering what the situation in Iraq was at that time.
No, that's not a surprise. But the other thing is how easy it was to walk off with that cash.
And the fact that an awful lot of this cash was paid not to just those Iraqi contractors on the street, who you would expect that would be the way to reimburse them, to pay them, but the fact a substantial amount of this cash went to American contractors, who you would think there would be another way to take care of them other than delivering bundles of cash in sacks.
To get money more into Iraqi hands. The investigative reporters, Don Bartlett and James Steele, with me for another few minutes on WNYC talking about their article in Vanity Fair, Billions Over Baghdad. Of the missing $9 billion, how much has eventually been accounted for in some way?
To our knowledge, none of it. You know, if you look down the list of where some of this money went, I mean, it was a fascinating story because later on there were some auditors after the horse was out of the barn who looked at certain aspects of this with the Pentagon and so forth. And some of the numbers are absolutely amazing. Like, for example, in one case, they turned over $1.5 billion in cash to Iraqi banks. I mean, the caller earlier made references to one of those deposits. Auditors were later only able to trace $500 million. You would think giving that much to a bank as opposed to a plumbing contractor mm-hmm. working on the streets of Iraq, that you would at least maybe have some idea where that went. They couldn't do it. Another contractor was paid really millions of dollars to hire 8,200 security guards. But when auditors later went through this, they could find there were only about 600 guards actually employed. So you're talking about another 7,400 ghost workers just in that one particular thing. Some of the entries in some of the auditing, that are not auditing books, but account books that the Coalition Provisional Authority had, simply would put down huge numbers like $500 million for security, to be determined.
Wow.
And there was never any explanation as to where that money went.
Is there any way to estimate how much of this $9 billion was spent honestly on things that actually went to buy things for the Iraqi people and how much was actually gobbled up in fraud or waste or theft?
You see how we're both racing to answer that question. No, the answer is a resounding no. You have to, when you look at these audit reports that were done after this money disappeared, that Jim is talking about, and these were UN auditors, you have to assume that the bulk of it vanished.
And you have to assume that obviously some of it did get into the hands of people who needed it. But again, there's never been any accounting to break that down.
Bob in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Hi, I appreciate the reference you guys made, the sort of backhanded reparations made to U.S. contractors with Iraqi money. But one of the things that I thought was very interesting is this NASA accounting guy who was complicit in some sort of huge fraud not too long ago. This makes me think that perhaps this was intelligently done to kind of back-channel funds into our black ops, which are so poorly funded now due to the oversight of the GAO and Congress. And I wonder what your callers, guests had to say about that.
We were waiting for your call.
Yes, can you have an index card
yes,
you're going to pull out
yes,
now?
No. Can we prove that? Of course not. But you put your finger on the most likely explanation for this. Look, the Pentagon is not staffed by dumb people. They did not put this firm in here with this background of being organized by someone who had been involved in a $200 million security swindle in an offshore area and then put this company in charge of monitoring the billions in Iraq. Somebody was playing some kind of a game. And the most likely answer is the one you just said.
And the CPA was an absolutely wonderful device to make this happen because it was a sieve for cash with no accountability.
Right. And best of all, as Paul Bremer is leaving Baghdad in the last 2 days, he issues an executive order or a regulation that grants immunity to anybody who did anything wrong. Again, that order, by the way, came from the Pentagon.
I was just going to ask you about that, and let's end on this. Paul Bremer laid down for everyone who worked as a contractor with the Coalition Provisional Authority a general amnesty for anything that they may have done that would be revealed in the future, correct?
It's your basic get out of jail free card, and that's it. And now, of course, that would not preclude U.S. prosecutors from looking at this, except the Justice Department is not doing so.
So you mean the amnesty was issued by that organization called the Coalition Provisional Authority, but American prosecutors, if they found an American company defrauding the American government or the CPA as a de facto arm of the American government, they could or couldn't prosecute.
Well, see, that's the beauty of the CPA. It's not an arm of the American government, and so it operates
outside.
It's
this catch-22 situation where they're not legitimate, and so therefore you can't go after them.
And some people may be thinking, well, okay, maybe general amnesty in that situation. It was an absolute emergency, an absolute risk of life and limb. Iraq had just fallen. People were looting. The chaos was just beginning. So you grant some kind of additional leeway to companies going in that situation.
Presumably this is their logic. But it's interesting to us. All through World War II, you know, we had monitoring of contractors in every situation. Even though a war of total, complete support by the American people, they decided all during the war to bring people up if they were overcharging, if they were behaving improperly. We don't have a shred of that out of this administration.
Another yardstick of the extent of this fraud, waste, corruption is the fact that we've now spent twice as much rebuilding Iraq as we did Japan following World War II
inflation-adjusted
dollars.
How would you tell a story to a 7-year-old? We may get the answer to that question in a minute, because our next guest is going to be William Jamison, a New York Times city editor who has written a book about talking about the news and other things to your young children. He also edited the Portraits of Grief series after 9/11 in the Times. So William Jamison coming up next. Wendell Jamison, forgive me. I will say goodbye now to James B. Steele and Donald Bartlett. Their investigative report, fascinating to listen to them describe, also to read in Vanity Fair magazine, is called Billions Over Baghdad. Thanks a lot.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Wendell Jamison in a minute.